Last year, James Beard award-winning author Paul Greenberg wrote what became one of the most emailed New York Times op-eds of last year. A New Year's climate diet, which offered a bucket list of things any American could do to shrink their carbon footprint. For a year now, Greenberg has been following his own advice, and along the way, he's written a book on the subject, The Climate Diet, 50 Simple Ways to Trim Your Carbon Footprint. It is now out, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Paul Greenberg to the roundtable this morning. Paul, thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Joe.
So what brought you to the idea originally to even write the op-ed?
I was looking at this crazy statistic came across my desk, which was that Americans turn out to be per capita the most impactful carbon emitters on the planet. So when I say that, it's like I think a lot of people think worst climate country on the planet is China. They emit, and it's true that, as a country, they emit much more than the United States does at this point. But per capita, Americans emit something like 16 tons of CO2 per person per year. And that's by far the highest amongst the largest economies in the world. So I sort of, it was coming to be New Year's, and, I know after New Year's, everyone thinks about going on a diet and so forth. And I thought, America kind of needs to go on a climate diet, on a carbon diet. And so using that sort of metaphor, I tried to think, the diets that are most successful tend to be sort of incremental, smallish changes that add up to, a lot over time. And so I was trying to think of, what kind of diet would that look like for the United States to be something that we could actually stick to? And that was the sense of the op-ed, and that's the sense of the book.
You write in the introduction to the book, this is not a gotcha book. Give us a sense of how you came to that and why you didn't want it to be that.
Well, to me, when I imagined this book and the conversations that preceded it, I'm sort of imagining like the Thanksgiving table where, the kid comes back from college having heard all about being a vegan and all the wasteful ways that their parents are living their lives, and then a big fight ensues, and the daughter's saying, or the son is saying, gotcha, 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 and the parents are like, what the, and then you get a conversation that goes absolutely nowhere. So I was trying to think about, what would a book that talks about climate that everybody of every political stripe and every generation could sit down and actually have a constructive conversation about. And so that's the point. It's not meant to sort of, lay the blame at the feet of any particular generation or political affiliation, but rather to say everybody is in a certain place vis-a-vis their carbon emissions. How can we take every single person and get them to do something, whether they're super virtuous already or not virtuous at all? How can we get everybody to a better place? And that's sort of what was my guiding principle.
You make the point, and I will say it surprised me, but you are not anti-meat in the book. You do talk about choosing an environmentally friendly diet, and that includes more chicken, less cheese, and so forth. So talk a little bit about how you came to the food choices that were part of this diet.
Yeah. Well, personally, I've been on a journey both for my health and for the planet as far as diet is concerned. And I've sort of settled into what I call a climatarian diet, where mostly plant-based, mostly vegan, with a little bit of fish each week. And then the very rarely occasional, sometimes I'll have some land food meat if it's a huge celebration. But the main point here is, again, going back to this idea of taking people where they are to a better place. So it turns out, actually, that going from beef to chicken, for example, not a vegan choice, maybe not a popular choice among vegans, but if you go from beef to chicken, you can cut your food footprint by 75%. So that's pretty significant. And again, my point being, it'd be great if everybody became vegan, but are we going to get people like in the heartland or in the heartland of New York State to just completely drop all animal products? Or could we say to your uncle who's, doesn't want to become vegan, hey, tonight, how about chicken? So those are the kind of choices that I'm hoping people will make.
And it's important to say that these are choices. You're very pro, what works for you, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think I once did a review of Bill McKibben's book, Earth, and
yes.
I said that, with two A's, exactly. And I put it out there at the end of that review that, it's hard to, one wonders whether choice will get us there and whether maybe we need instead a kind of environmental Lenin who will force these things upon us. That may yet come to pass, but I do think we still have some wiggle room to get there through democratic ways. And when I say choice, it's not just, you know, your particular footprint and lowering that, you know, just lowering it for you. There's a lot of stuff in the Climate Diet book about making choices that actually affect corporate behavior and government behavior. Like, for example, when you invest, you now actually could put together an investment portfolio that will earn you as much, if not more, if you invest in fossil-free stocks and bonds. So, like, for example, there's an ETF of the S&P index. The standard one is SPY, but there's a fossil fuel variation, which is SPYX, ticker symbol SPYX, no fossil fuels in that portfolio. That one actually outperformed the regular SPY. So maybe if we were to all make those kinds of choices, we could start really creating the levers for moving both business and government in the right direction.
Paul Greenberg is our guest on the roundtable this morning, the new book, The Climate Diet. You write about water in the book. I found this interesting. 90% of Americans, you say, have access to clean tap water, so use it.
That's right. Drink from the tap. I mean, that's in the eating drinking section of the book. But yeah, it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, I'm not sure how old you are. I'm 53. I remember a time when there was no bottled water.
Yes, exact same age as you. So go ahead.
Oh, there you go. And so I remember when they were like having Perrier ads. It's like, oh,
right.
Perrier. Well, okay, I guess it's got bubbles. But the idea of selling water in a bottle to me at the time seemed as ridiculous as selling air in a bottle. So I think we need to kind of unlearn that habit because, you know, roughly 42 gallons a year of bottled water Americans drink, that results in the expenditure of 17 million barrels of oil. So it's a lot, and it's not necessary. And if 90% of us have access to clean water, why don't we drink it? I mean, especially in the North Country and, you know, where WAMC is, I mean, you got the Adirondacks feeding a lot of your water system.
Right.
It's some of the best water in the world.
In the family life section, you talk about the importance of shrinking things, whether it be a wedding or a conference or family gatherings, and really just to take tons, millions of tons off of our national carbon emissions. Have you seen, now we have been forced to, as you said, environmental Lenin, but we've been forced really to cut back on a lot of this stuff because of the pandemic over the year. So it is like we have a place where we can say, oh, well, maybe we don't have to go back to.
It's true. We did we did have an environmental Lenin on our backs in the form of COVID, and we actually did cut our emissions as a country. We cut it by 10%, which is pretty shocking. The thing is, though, a lot of these things I think we learned that we were doing, we learned that a lot of things were just not that necessary. The conference, for example, is it really truly necessary to follow, to fly everyone in your company, you know, to Aruba or wherever, you know, for this conference? There are a couple of conferences that I used to attend yearly that I attended virtually during COVID, and they were totally fine virtually. The other big one is weddings. You know, weddings have a huge, huge climate footprint. I think people in this sort of the bridezilla and Grumenstein phase that we were in pre-COVID, people would just do ridiculous amounts of stuff for weddings. But now that, you know, the industry now calls the weddings we've been having over the last year, they call it cozy weddings. I think the cozy wedding should be the standard. I don't think we need 200 people at your wedding. And even if you were to say, no, I do need 200 people at my wedding, then make your wedding schedule it in a central place where people have to fly the least to get to it. So I think at the very least we need to make that kind of plan, but I'd much prefer a much smaller wedding with a much smaller footprint.
You also write in that section about we can just calm down on buying stuff,
yeah.
Whether it be things for ourselves or gift buying and going online and that we don't have to be accumulating as much stuff as we do.
It's funny, the other day I was on a radio program. There's a really kooky performance artist here in the city called the Reverend Billy, and he's the Reverend Billy of the Church of Stop Shopping. And, you know, he's a preacher who preaches the gospel of not buying so much stuff. I think when we really are faced with the reality of it, what shopping represents more and more is the natural world being turned into junk for us. And if we think about that, and we think every time we reach for something or each to press a button, that that purchase is a little bit of nature being turned into more junk, I think we might take a pause. And if we also, furthermore, think about the carbon emissions that are created by the junk that we buy, and also just the plain old boxes. There's a stat in the Climate Diet book about the fact that if we continue at the rate that we're going with boxes and Amazon and so forth, that you know something like 5% of the actual number of trees in the Amazon will have to be used for boxes. I mean, that's ridiculous. And I don't think there's a household in this country, poor or rich, that doesn't think they couldn't be better off with less stuff.
And when it comes to gifts, I mean, there's a thing in the book about, well, you know, you could, if you're buying for someone, you could maybe put money toward their college education or to some other thing that they're looking for as opposed to stuff.
Sure. I mean, how many of, I don't know, you know, since we're the same age, we may have children the same age. Like my son is 14. Yep. And when I look at the amount of junk in the drawers of presents that were given to us that were maybe given a flitting glance by my son, if that same $20, $30 had gone into a college fund, it would be by now worth $150, and it would be, you know, and we all know how expensive college is. So I mean, I'd say why not a heartfelt letter to that person and the money itself go into something that doesn't require anything to be burned carbon-wise, but put it in their college fund. Put it in somebody's. How many people do you know do not have enough money for their retirement, you know, and would really welcome something that they couldn't even get their hands on, but it would be put into the form of a mutual fund or something in their retirement account? There are means to do this. There's a company called YouGift that allows you to put money directly into people's college funds. I think that that's much. You know, in the short term, something like the child might go, "Oh, but I wanted a I wanted a drone." Da 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 da. Well, you know, later down the line, they'll see what's in their college account and they'll think of you.
Right. Go to college, build your own drone. When you look at the climate diet, there's a home section in the book, and yep. You talk about a lot of different things, and a couple things I want to key into here. One yep. is the importance of solar energy and how you can sign up for that without having to do something as drastic as getting off the grid.
That's right. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of men in their man caves are like, one day I'm going to get off the grid and solar energy in my house. But, you know, most people are never going to get around to actually cutting the wires and putting in their own solar. And frankly, it's pretty expensive. But there are more and more opportunities to route alternative energy into your home. You can choose what's called an ESCO, an energy service company that is exclusively does renewable energy. And you can just go online. The Climate Diet tells you how to do this. Go online and choose the power that you want. In some areas, you can go even better. There are actually community solar programs that are a little bit like, you know, you ever go sign up for a CSA, a community supported agriculture. This is like that, but for solar power. And that, what's cool about that is it actually encourages the development of, you know, municipal and regional solar power generation, which is really the direction we need to go in. So, yeah, it can be done. It should be done. There's no need to, you know, and once you have sustainable electricity going into your house, then you can start tackling the bigger questions of your appliances, you know, switching over from gas to an efficient electric stove, all kinds of things like that. The thing is, we have to start the process, and we all have to start the process as soon as possible.
We have so many options of things that are out there that are quote unquote smart. Our smart speakers that can turn our heater up or down or the air conditioning or whatever the case may be. How smart are they really, and should we rely on them in some way of remaining on a climate diet?
So the main smart item I recommend is your thermostat. So switching to a programmable thermostat in which you actually put in your energy, you know, observe your heating and cooling pattern. Because remember, heating and cooling is the largest energy user in your house. But find what your pattern is and program it into your thermostat. And by the way, a programmable thermostat is usually very cheap to install. It's like $100 or something like that. So that's really good. Now, where smart things steer us wrong is in something called vampire power or standby power. A lot of things like game consoles, your cell phone, your computer, have a kind of almost off but not quite off mode, which allows you to power up quickly. So this actually is draining energy at a pretty significant rate, something like, I think, 1.5% of our energy uses. 4.6, I'm looking at my own book, 4.6% of America's annual residential CO2 emissions are coming from vampire power. So it's a lot. And so I've found, actually, I have another book that I wrote recently called Goodbye Phone, Hello World, and it's all about kind of detaching from your digital devices. I have found that actually shutting everything down at the end of the night is really good for your mental health, and it's really good for the Earth's health, it turns out. So that's an area where things are maybe too smart for their own good.
And I want to get to some of the other sections in the book, but I don't want to leave this before we leave the home section. But the big bad culprit of using a lot of power in our home is our dryer.
Indeed it is. And, you know, there's a really simple fix for this one. Surprise, surprise, now that summer is upon us or fast approaching, drying clothes on the line turns out to be really good. Dryers are hugely, hugely energy intensive. Sometimes they're gas powered, which is, you know, even worse. But drying stuff on the line is great. It's also great because dryers tend to beat up your clothes and you know, decrease yeah. their overall lifespan. And it turns out actually that clothes are a pretty big part of your carbon footprint. So, you know, something like 5.5 kilograms of emissions for a polyester shirt, 4.3 for a cotton one. So having your clothes last longer while also not burning through a lot of power in your dryer, these are two big pluses. I mean, I know it's some people can think it a little déclassé to, you know, have their clothes hanging up on the line. But, you know, again, this is a lot about this is status and what we perceive as being high status. And what if hanging your clothes out in the line was a sign of high status? I think it would be very good for us and very good for the planet.
Also, smells great.
It does smell great.
Really does. You can't beat that smell. When it comes to, so let's talk about the financial part of the book. And
yeah.
a lot of this is what we can do, choices that we can make as, that we've been talking about throughout our conversation, but also putting some pressure on financial institutions as well.
Yeah, for truly. You know, it turns out that there are a handful of banks that are the most intensive about underwriting fossil fuel ventures. J.P. Morgan Chase, far at the top of the investment banks that underwrite fossil fuels. So, you know, frankly, moving your money away from those institutions is a signal. The other thing is to think about how you're investing. You know, I mentioned before that you could invest in a fossil fuel-free ETF of the first version of the Standard & Poor, the SPYX fossil-free ETF. But there's many other ways that you can go about it. There's whole sectors of different kinds of investment strategies. So people really should explore that. They also should think about their insurance companies, because it turns out actually fossil fuel companies really rely on insurance to do, you know, edgy things now, like, you know, prospecting for oil in the Arctic. If we do business only with insurance companies that stay away from that kind of thing, I think that also sends a message to the industry.
So some of that is subtle activism. Let us talk about more overt activism. And
sure.
as you write in the book, there is an activism section in the book that,
yep.
I mean, that can be a part of the climate diet, and we can make change that way, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, nobody would deny, and, you know, I always hear Bill McKibben whispering in my ear saying, you know, no, it's not just personal choice. We got to change the system. And it's true. You have to change the system. But I think, you know, if you just tell somebody who's not doing anything, you need to get involved, I think they find that pretty overwhelming and not finding a point of entry. So I think, you know, there's a bunch of things you can do. You know, one thing I suggest is to be specific with your local politicians or with any politician. If you shout at a politician, I want you to fight climate change, they don't know what to do with that. Politicians are very much programmed into a very specific groove. So, like, you know, for example, in Schenectady, if there were a measure put before the city council to switch buses to electric vehicles instead of gas-powered buses, that's something that your local politician could take action on. So you know, do a little research, try to find out what are the key climate issues that have to do with your specific municipality and where you can step in and have your voice heard.
One of the things, and we'll probably end on this, is that you can also, as you state, that you can get the greenest candidates on the ballot. How do we define, how do you define, how should we define a green candidate?
I think a green candidate is, first and foremost, somebody who kind of keeps their promises when they actually get into office. A lot of people take individual donations. A lot of candidates take individual donations with the promise, or of being climate forward. And then when they get into office, they bend to the reality of the situation. This is why I suggest when you're donating to a candidate that you, instead of going directly to the candidate, you look. Several of the large NGOs like NRDC have separate donation vehicles which bundle a lot of different individual contributions and then donate it to a candidate, but it's very much earmarked towards that candidate behaving well vis-a-vis their promises on the climate. So that's one way to do it. I think, you know, you can also look at the League of Conservation Voters. They actually keep records of everybody's vote. So if you're thinking about voting for an incumbent, you can actually check their record vis-a-vis climate legislation. So, you know, it's a matrix of things, but it is something that you can have an influence on. You can be a better voter. You can be a better donator. It's just you need to be a little bit more informed.
In following your own advice, what has been the hard part?
That's a good question. Well, you know, the diet part, the eating part, has been easier and easier. You know, I've moved to a mostly vegan diet, and I enjoy it, actually. And I enjoy the challenge it gives me because I'm the cook in the house. I think the trickier thing is to disentangle yourself from companies that, are not behaving so well. I still have a Chase credit card, and I'm hoping to get rid of it. We're actually going to do, some talking around that at a green market event that I'm doing in New York on May 21st. But, you know, like, I try to get a credit card through one of the banks that I suggest in the finance section. And even though I have, like, really good credit rating and stuff like that, for whatever reason, my credit card got declined from this, you know, this green bank. And I'm like, geez, what's a guy got to do? So, you know, cutting those cords. No, seriously, like, you know, it's like, what, you're denying me the credit card? But, you know, cutting those cords, reestablishing new cords, understanding that it's going to be a little clunky until you smooth things out. When I think about it, you know, I enjoyed the challenge of fixing my actual, you know, food diet. The rest of it is maybe not so immediately enjoyable to me, but I realize I need to persist, and it will, you know, I think make me feel better on a day-to-day basis when I do.
Hard to believe there are banks that don't know just how much a journalist makes.
Yeah.
Kind of money you're rolling in.
That badly, but it was really weird.
The name of the new book, The Climate Diet, 50 Simple Ways to Trim Your Carbon Footprint. The author is Paul Greenberg. Paul, it's a great pleasure to have you on this program. I wish you all the luck in the world with the book and being up this way. And I thank you very much for the time this morning.
My very great pleasure. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Again, Paul Greenberg is the author of The Climate Diet. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.